Holzman Basketball, Reinsdorf said in announcing the changes. An unselfish team, one that plays team defense, that knows its roles, that moves without the ball. Jerry Krause's job will be to find the DeBuscher of 1985 and the Bradley of 1985. Krause had been named the Bulls GM once before, about 5 years earlier, and lasted all of a few months before he got crossed up, offering to hire DePaul's Ray Meyer as the team's coach. Krause's mistake was that he didn't have the authority to make the offer to Meyer. Bulls ownership promptly fired him in the wake of that very public embarrassment, making him the laughingstock of the city. The news of his return hit the sports desks at Chicago newspapers like a bomb. Jerry Krause is going to be Michael's boss? Jerry had this reputation for being a guy who went out in public with gravy stains on his tie, longtime Chicago sportswriter Bill Gleason once explained. Personally, I never saw any gravy stains, but some of the other guys claimed they did. Of course, he was overweight. Jerry always had a problem with overeating. He stood just under 5'6 and weighed 260 pounds. Jerry's been around forever, said one longtime Bulls employee in 1998. He knew all the coaches, the assistants, the scouts in the league. The previous Bulls administration despised Jerry. They had all these stories and tales and ripped him all the time. Lo and behold, if he didn't come back here and get the job as general manager. Krause was elated to return to the Bulls. I'd left in disgrace, and I'd come back on top, he explained. His first step was to fire coach Kevin Loughery. His second was to bring in his old friend Tex Winter, a retired college coach, to work with the coaching staff that Krause would hire. He picked journeyman Stan Albeck, most recently of the New Jersey Nets, to replace Loughery. I knew it was a mistake almost as soon as I did it, Krause would say later. Then he turned his attention to the roster. I had a brutal start, Krause recalled. I had 9 players I didn't want, and 3 I did. I wanted Dave Corzine, I wanted Rod Higgins, and I wanted Michael. The rest of them I couldn't have cared less about. And they were talented. All of them were very talented. But it wasn't a question of talent. Krause recalled sitting down to discuss the team with Jordan. I told him, I believe you have a chance to be a great player. I'm going to try to get players around you to work with you. He said, no, don't get players who can work with me. Get players we can win with. After 2 decades of upheaval in the team's front office, Bulls fans were openly leery of Krause's seemingly unorthodox approach. But Krause knew what he wanted and set about the business of making it happen. He had long told himself that if he ever got another chance as an NBA general manager, he had a certain vision of what he wanted to build. It began with Tex Winter's basketball system, the triangle offense. Second, he wanted to develop Phil Jackson as a head coach. Krause had known Jackson since the days he had scouted him in hopes of drafting him. The son of 2 Pentecostal preachers, Jackson had been raised in Montana and North Dakota. By the end of high school, he longed for relief from his strict upbringing and found escape with an athletic scholarship to the University of North Dakota, where he played basketball for an engaging young coach named Bill Fitch. The 6'8" Jackson developed into a 2-time NCAA Division II All-American, a legitimate pro prospect. Krause and Holzman were probably the only 2 pro scouts that had made their way out to North Dakota to check out Jackson. As a Knicks fan, Reinsdorf liked Krause's idea of developing Jackson into an NBA coach. After his 13-year playing career in New York and New Jersey ended, Jackson had worked as an assistant coach and broadcaster for the Nets before moving on to become head coach of the Albany Patroons in the Continental Basketball Association for 5 seasons. In 1984, Jackson's Patroons won the CBA title, and the next season he was named CBA Coach of the Year. He was coaching in Puerto Rico when Krause contacted him about an assistant coaching job with the Bulls in 1985. I kept up with Phil as a player through the years, Krause recalled. We'd talk from time to time, and I followed his coaching career in the CBA. When I got the job in Chicago in 1985, I talked to him again. I told him I needed scouting reports on the CBA. Within a week, I had typewritten reports on the whole league, details on every player. I went to the CBA and had some success, Jackson recalled, but still nothing came in my direction. Jerry Krause was like the only person that really stayed in touch with me from the NBA world, and he had just gotten back in it. But that was my connection. Jerry had seen me play in college, and we had a relationship that spanned 20 years. Jerry's a remarkable guy. He's an enigma to the athletic world. He's not what you would consider an athlete. And even as a scout back there 30 years ago, he was a very unusual type of fellow to be out there scouting a basketball player. Jackson had been known as a nonconformist during his playing days with the Knicks. In Maverick, his 1975 autobiography written with Charlie Rosen for Playboy Press, Jackson recalled his exploration of 60s counterculture. In the book, he talked openly about taking LSD and other drugs, which just about guaranteed that no NBA team considered him coaching material. "I've never read the book," Krause once explained. "I didn't need to. I knew about Phil's character." While putting together a staff that offseason, Krause set up Jackson to interview with Stan Albeck for the job of assistant coach. He showed up in Chicago with a full beard and wearing sandals and a straw hat with a large parrot feather in it. "Stan and I had a very short interview," Jackson remembered. Albeck later told Krause, "I don't want that guy under any circumstances." Actually, Albeck wasn't much interested in Tex Winter's system either. Having run aground over coaching issues in his first tenure as the Bulls GM, Krause wasn't about to have another blow-up with his second opportunity. So he backed off and told Jackson he'd try him some other time. Meanwhile, Krause had done some frantic, last-minute maneuvering to draft Virginia Union's Charles Oakley, a bulky, little-known forward in the 1985 draft. As with many Krause moves, the pick was not a popular one in Chicago. "Charles was a tough kid, and he didn't take anything from anyone," recalled former Bulls assistant Johnny Bock. "You could tell he was strong-willed as a person, and he wanted to play. He wanted to prove to people coming from a small school that he was worthy of his selection in the draft, and he was committed to playing hard." Oakley soon developed into just the power forward the Bulls needed, a protector of Jordan from the Bill Laimbeers of the world. Krause went looking for other pieces, what he called OKP, our kind of people. "Jerry took away a lot of things that this franchise didn't need," Phil Jackson would say later of Krause's early moves. "It didn't need certain types of people on the club. He had a certain idea of what type of person he wanted. He brought in character, or what he liked to think of as character. Good, solid people. People who wanted to work hard." The Needle. For all his ambition and insight, Krause quickly aired that first year back in Chicago in that he needlessly alienated Jordan, which would put their relationship on a negative footing for the next 15 years. Among the early steps Krause took was the trading of Jordan's best friend on the team. "We traded Rod Higgins," Krause admitted later. Michael was upset about that. Krause later reacquired Higgins, only to trade him yet again. It was the kind of move that left observers wondering whether Krause took pride, perhaps even pleasure, in challenging Jordan. In his years of scouting, Krause had studied the game's all-time greats, just as he had put in hours scouting talent at America's traditionally black colleges. Krause was immensely proud of his background, and often expounded to Jordan on the game's greatest players, and on his own scouting credentials. "I used to needle him," Krause recalled of his early conflict with Jordan. "I used to say, someday you might be as good as Earl Monroe. You remind me of Earl and Elgin. You're a combination of Earl Monroe and Elgin Baylor, and you might be as good as both of them someday. Earl did it on the ground. You're doing it in the air. Elgin was the first one to do it in the air. You remind me of him." And then every time after that he'd say, "That fucking Monroe." Then he'd say, "Where'd you take Monroe? Second in the draft? Big fucking deal. I think that whole thing with Michael stems from Earl Monroe." Bulls employees who happened to witness these exchanges would cringe at Krause's insistence on challenging Jordan. "If you're going to toss things out towards Michael, they better be true," Tim Hallam explained, "because he never forgets and he never lets go." Ultimately, the new GM's needling would ruin any chance he had at a cordial relationship with the star of the team he was managing. But Krause seemed driven by the disrespect he sensed in Jordan's response to him. Jordan, meanwhile, pushed for the only thing he really trusted. He wanted the team to sign Buzz Peterson or to acquire Walter Davis, and he seemed generally in favor of anything related to North Carolina, which left Krause rolling his eyes. After a while, Jordan simply decided to avoid the new GM at all costs. Such were the gnarly twists in the plotline of Jordan's professional career. It hinged on a chemistry of two men chained together by Providence, one badly in need of affection, the other doing everything possible to avoid giving it. The strangest part of their pairing was Krause's collection of insecurities and Jordan's absolute lack of them. Despite that, Krause would prove to be one of the strongest personalities who ever stepped into Jordan's path. The acrimony between the two men sharpened as Jordan headed into his second season. Many of pro basketball's old hands thought that Krause seemed to be making the whole process unnecessarily difficult. "Michael was going to be the premier star in the NBA," Kevin Loughery recalled. "You had the man to build around. You knew you were going to get better every year by adding parts. You have to have a star in the NBA to have a good team. When you have a star, you have the opportunity to put the other pieces in. Not only was he a star, he could do so many things. He could handle three spots, The point, the off-guard, the small forward. I guess if you had to put him down low, he could do that. He could rebound, he could pass. A star who could do so many things. He wasn't just one-dimensional like a lot of stars are. He made it easier to put a team together. Among the new faces that Kraus brought into training camp that year was George Gervin, the Iceman, who had starred for years for the San Antonio Spurs. He was one of the veterans who had participated in the All-Star freeze-out of Jordan, so the chemistry set the stage for some testy dynamics at training camp that fall. The team's young star didn't go out of his way to welcome Gervin, who knew if there was any bending to be done in the circumstances, he'd have to do it. He was a young guy on his way in, Gervin recalled of Jordan, then all of 22. He hadn't proven his greatness at that time. He had shown potential to be great, but he was a young guy in the league trying to make a name for himself, like most young guys coming up. True to his MO, Jordan soon challenged Gervin to a game of one-on-one. We played, Gervin acknowledged, implying that he was no match for Jordan's boundless energy. We shot around. I was a veteran on my way out, so he was messing with the old Iceman. He wasn't messing with the Iceman of old. You know what I'm saying? I knew that I was just there to contribute. I'd had my time in the life. I knew it was his turn, so I was just really playing out my last year in the NBA. He had his own style. Mike was a great athlete. He developed that jump shot later on in his career. I was a jump shooter and a scorer from the beginning. So we had different kinds of games. He jumped a lot, I glided a lot. I was like Fred Astaire, he was like a jumping jack. The one-on-one broke the ice between the two, but Jordan wasn't about to allow Gervin into his inner circle. I didn't talk to him that much, Gervin explained, adding that he suspected Jordan still smarted over the All-Star incident. I had nothing but respect for him back then because I saw the drive that he had. Inside himself, not on the floor. I'm talking about the drive that he had to try to win. You could tell that by the practices and stuff. He didn't let up. He had a hell of a drive in him, man. To succeed, man, and to win. The older guard quickly saw the distinct line between Jordan's inner circle and the rest of the team. He was close to quite a few guys, Charles Oakley, Rod Higgins. We really wasn't that close, Gervin recalled. But that's just the way it was. You know, life is funny. The game is one thing, but the most important thing is building relationships. I think that was my greatest gift in my career, is that I built some relationships with my teammates. I appreciated them, and they knew it wasn't all about me. The circumstances with the Bulls early in that second season revealed a challenge that Jordan would have to face eventually. His elite circle of friends set up an immediate division within any roster he played on. You were either in his circle or you weren't. The majority of his teammates, particularly in those early years, were kept at a cool arm's length, on the outside looking in. Jordan needed his cocoon to survive, but at the same time he would have to learn that no man was an island, Gervin observed. You gotta work not to be on that island. You gotta work hard at it, man. The Bulls opened the schedule in the late fall of 1985 with three straight wins, but in the third game against the Golden State Warriors, Jordan suffered a broken navicular tarsal bone in his left foot, an injury that had altered or ended the careers of several NBA players. Predicting he would be back quickly, he sat out the next game with what was reported as an ankle injury. It was the first game he had missed in his entire career, including high school, including even the broken wrist he suffered 4 weeks before his sophomore season opener at North Carolina. I feel like a fan, he told reporters the day after the injury at Golden State. I can't do a thing. I've just got to watch them and cheer along. Then came the diagnosis. After that, the year was a complete disaster, Jerry Reinsdorf recalled. Jordan would miss the next 64 games. Around the league, veterans gave each other knowing looks. Jordan's relentless, all-out style had finally caught up with him. He had it all the time, Gervin recalled, summing up the conventional wisdom. That's why he probably got hurt, because he played so hard all the time. The news of the broken foot fell like an avalanche on Nike, who had just invested millions in Jordan. I mean, the whole game was going to be over, Vaccaro recalled. We realized that everything could have ended. Jordan shared their fears. I was a little bit scared, he explained later. I didn't want to be bothered by anyone. I didn't want the phone to ring. I didn't want to watch TV. I didn't want to hear music. I just wanted plain darkness because this was something for me to deal with, and it was very painful. For the first time, I had to consider doing something else besides playing basketball, and it was very different. Once the reality of his injury settled in, his first thought was to go back home, an idea that was met with immediate disapproval. Michael wanted to go back to North Carolina and rehab there, recalled Mark File, the Bulls trainer at the time. We were able to get that across to Jerry Reinsdorf and Jerry Krause and set up a program for Michael in Carolina. He rehabbed, worked on his degree, and had some peace of mind. That probably made Michael ready to compete when he returned. Some observers, including several teammates, criticized Jordan for leaving the team while he was injured. Even though he had played in only 3 games, Jordan led the Eastern Conference in the fans' All-Star voting that winter. "I was very frustrated, and at first I didn't know how to deal with the situation," Jordan recalled. "I walked away from it, went to North Carolina, worked on my degree, and watched the team on TV. That's the best way I could deal with it." While in Chapel Hill, he sat on Carolina's bench during games, which gave him the opportunity for the first time to sit back and observe the system that had molded him. As his foot began to feel better, he ventured into forbidden territory and began playing pickup ball, unknown to Reinsdorf or Kraus. "I heard that much later, that after 2 weeks he was back on the court," Kraus recalled. "I don't know if that's accurate, but I heard it. He never said he played. We had a meeting 3 weeks later on the phone. 'How are you?' 'I'm much better. The doctors still want you to rest. Come on in here in the next couple of weeks. We're going to look at you again.' This went on for 2 months. "I knew he was playing down there because he told me," Sonny Vaccaro recalled. "I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, 'I'm going to go and see if this damn thing, this SOB, is okay. I'm going to see if I can do this. I need to be away from people, and I know I'll be protected.'" That knowledge both reassured and further terrified the Nike staff that had bet on his career in a major way. Without Jordan, Stan Albeck had to turn to Gervin as one of his main offensive options. Albeck had coached Gervin in San Antonio, so the Bulls switched to a set of plays to feature the Iceman. "Stan tried the best he could under the circumstances," recalled Chicago radio reporter Cheryl Ray Stout. "Without Michael, that team had a lot of guys who didn't care. During the timeouts, you had players like Sid Green who wouldn't even go in the huddles." "It was hard for Stan," Sidney Green recalled in 1995. "Unfortunately, he had high expectations for the team and for Michael. Once Michael went down, Stan had to change his whole game plan. He tried to build the whole team around George Gervin, but unfortunately, George was on his last legs. But he still had the finger roll. Beyond George, we were all young. You must also remember that that was the year Quinton Daly had his problems, too. Daly had fallen into a spiral of missed games and late appearances. After he missed a game in February, Kraus suspended him. For the second time in 8 weeks, Daly entered a drug treatment facility. Quinton was late to another shoot-around, and by then I knew he was messed up on coke," Kraus said. "We were waiting around for him to show up for the game, and Stan said, 'I'm going to play him if he shows up.' I told him, 'The guy's done in a Bulls uniform.' I made the decision then to begin looking for another coach." The team's lack of direction in Jordan's absence indicated just how much of a load he had been carrying. The Bulls' record stood at 22-43 in March when he told management that he believed his injury was healed and he wanted to return. "I didn't want to watch my team go down the pits," he later explained. "I thought I was healthy enough to contribute something." His plans caught Reinsdorf by surprise and sparked another harsh confrontation with Kraus. The owner and GM had serious questions about the risk of Jordan's returning too soon. "The thing that got Michael and me off on the wrong foot," Kraus recalled, "was that he thought I said to him, 'You're our property, and you'll do what we want you to do.' I don't remember ever saying it that way. He just misinterpreted me. I was trying to keep him from playing because he had a bad foot, and the doctors were saying no, no, no. And Reinsdorf was telling him about risk. He was a kid who wanted to play. And I couldn't blame him. But that's where it all started because we said, 'We're going to hold you back.' We were all sitting in that room, and Stan wouldn't do a damn thing to help. Stan could have helped us explain the situation to Michael, but he was being selfish. He could have stood with us and the doctors who said Michael wasn't ready to play." Kraus recalled Jordan sitting there with steam coming out of his ears. He said, "You're telling me I can't play?" The more they talked, the more Jordan's fury grew. "Here you are dealing with big businessmen who make millions, and my millions are like pennies to them," he later recalled. "All I wanted to do was play the game that I've played for a long, long time. But they didn't look at it that way. They looked at it as protecting their investment, to keep their millions and millions coming in. That's when I really felt used. That's the only time I really felt used as a professional athlete. I felt like a piece of property." "I was scared to death," Kraus said of the situation. "I didn't want to go down in history as the guy who put Michael Jordan back in too soon." Jordan sensed that management wanted to keep losing to improve the team's position in the draft. "Losing games on purpose reflects what type of person you really are," he told the Tribune, a comment that would resonate years later when he became an NBA owner. "No one should ever try to lose to get something better. You should always try to make the best with what you have. If they really wanted to make the playoffs, I'd be in there whenever we had a chance to win a game." It was like a soap opera, Reinsdorf remembered in 1995. We were too honest with Michael. We let him hear the report from the three doctors we consulted with over when he could come back. All three said the break had not healed enough. They said if he did play, there was about a 10-15% chance of ending his career. Michael was such a competitor, he just wanted to play. I thought he was entitled to hear what the doctors had to say. I never thought he'd risk his entire career. It just didn't make any sense to me. But Michael figured that the 10-15% risk meant the odds were 85-90% that he wouldn't get hurt. To me, it didn't fit any risk-reward ratio. Here, the reward was to come back and play on a team that had already had a bad year. Why risk your whole career for that reward? Michael insisted that he knew his own body better than I did. So we reached a compromise that he would play gradually, just 7 minutes a half at first. Jordan vented his anger by almost single-handedly driving the Bulls through a reversal of fortune. That's the way Mike was, Mark File explained. If he didn't think something was going to hurt him, he'd focus past it and play. Sprains, groin pulls, muscle spasms, flu, Michael's first question always was, is it going to hurt me to play? If I told him no, it was gone. He'd focus past it. They put a limitation on how many minutes Michael could play, Cheryl Ray Stout remembered. They literally ran a clock on how many minutes he could play. Stan would sit there and have to calculate the time. He was under duress the whole time with Michael's return. There was some skepticism that the minutes limitations were there to help them get a lottery pick. That's a question to which we'll never know the answer. In one game, Albeck played Jordan longer than he was supposed to, Reinsdorf recalled. I told Kraus to tell him not to do that again. Stan told us what he thought of that. The next game was at Indiana, and with 25 or 30 seconds to go, the Bulls were down by a point. Just then, Michael reached the 7 minute mark, and Stan pulled him from the game. He pulled him just to show us how ridiculous he thought the 7 minutes were, how arbitrary it was. The Bulls still won the game on a jumper by John Paxson, but Reinsdorf was furious. Albeck had made him look foolish. The one thing I could never understand, File said, was how could Michael practice for 2 hours, yet he couldn't play but 14 minutes. Michael's minutes increased after it became obvious we could make the playoffs, Reinsdorf said. Finally, Kraus went down at halftime of a game late in the season and told the trainer to tell Stan to play Michael as many minutes as possible. I shouldn't have let him play at all that year. It was wrong. God's Disguise. Jordan's return to full-time status helped the Bulls win 6 of their final 13 games. They finished 30-52, just enough to sneak into the playoffs with a late-season win over Washington. The 8th-seeded Bulls faced the top-seeded Boston Celtics in the first round. Led by team president Red Auerbach and coached by Casey Jones, Boston would finish the year with a 50-1 home record. Larry Bird was in the process of winning his third straight MVP award, and the Celtics were moving through a period of 4 straight trips to the NBA Finals, which would net them 2 championships. It was a great, great basketball team with a front court that included Bird, forward Kevin McHale, and centers Robert Parrish and Bill Walton. They were all on a determined march to the franchise's 16th championship. It was a team, Bill Walton remembered, that could win any type of game, had a complete roster, brilliant coach, phenomenal leadership in the front office with Red, spectacular fans, perfect home court advantage. And it had Larry Bird, who was the greatest player I ever played with. Larry Bird, who was able to ignite the home fans more so than any other player I ever saw. And as great as Larry Bird was as a player, he's an even better human being, a better leader. And as great as our visions and memories and dreams of Larry Bird are as a player, he was better than that. He was better because the game, the rules, the clock, the refs, it all put too many restraints on him because he was a creative artist. He was Michelangelo. He was Bob Dylan. He was the guy who saw things that nobody else did, and then he was able to take that dream and that spark and turn it into action. There was nobody like Larry Bird. Boston coach Casey Jones had been perhaps the game's greatest ball pressure guard, winning championship after championship alongside Bill Russell. Jones's confidence was as supreme as his players that April. He saw no need to make any special effort against the ragtag Chicago Bulls and their young star coming off the injured list. We really didn't have anything set up to double-team him, Kevin McHale recalled. We didn't do anything. We just said, let him score. And you remember the first game he went crazy. Unburdened by double teams, Jordan scored 49 points in 43 minutes in Game 1, but Boston still squashed Chicago 123-104. This one-on-one defense is not exactly working for the Celtics on Jordan, broadcaster Tommy Heinsohn said at halftime of that first game. Sharing the assignment against Jordan for that series were Dennis Johnson and Denny Ainge, both excellent defenders, and substitutes Rick Carlisle and Jerry Seasting. After that first game, we said we should probably double-team him or do some stuff, McHale recalled, and Casey Jones said, "We'll think about it. I mean, they won 30 games, we won 67. There was no chance they were going to beat us." Jordan had something else in mind 3 nights later before Game 2 in Boston Garden. It was total silence in the locker room before the game, Sidney Green remembered. Michael was extremely focused, and we knew he was intent on doing something big. The contest went to double overtime. In 53 minutes of playing time, Jordan took 41 shots and made 22 of them. The Celtics fouled him plenty, and he made 19 of 21 free throws. He also registered 6 assists, 5 rebounds, 3 steals, and 4 turnovers in the box score. His 63 points was the NBA's all-time single-game playoff record. "That's God disguised as Michael Jordan," Bird said afterward. The comment would play for eternity in the Jordan highlight reel. For that single moment, he had frightened the cockiness out of the best team in basketball. "In the first game, he scored 49 and we won by 20, Walton recalled. And we said, "Ah, he'll never do that again." So the next game, he scores 63 points, fouls out the entire team, and if it wasn't for Larry Bird going crazy, then we wouldn't have won in double overtime, 135-131. Bird scored 36 points in 56 minutes of playing time that day, and it took scoring from Boston's entire roster just to counter Jordan's effort. McHale scored 27, Ainge 24, Johnson 15, Parrish 13, and Walton 10. "We really didn't scheme at all for him, to be truthful," McHale remembered. "We kind of just went out there and just said, 'Hey, well, you know, we're just going to play our normal defense. If you score on us, who cares?' No one assumed he'd get 60-some. Walton recalled, "In the locker room after that second game, we said, 'This guy's pretty good. Why don't we just double-team him and let's see if Dave Corzine and the rest of the Bulls can do anything out there?" Facing double teams and the sheer size of the Celtics, Jordan took just 18 shots in Game 3 in Chicago Stadium and made 8 of them. He finished with 19 points, 12 rebounds, and 9 assists as his team was swept, 122-104. "We double-teamed him and got the ball out of his hands," McHale said. "We really schemed for him. People forget we swept that series. It was 3-0, and we went home." The outcome of the series hardly seemed to matter. The entire NBA and its fan base were abuzz over Jordan's performance. 4 years earlier, he had captured the attention of a nationwide audience with a dramatic shot to win a national championship. The performance against Bird and his Celtics carried the Jordan legend to new heights. Coaches from across the NBA were riveted, just as fans were, by what he had done against the very best team in basketball. "It was marvelous," Sidney Green said. "I know Michael. He's the type of guy who loves for people to think that he can't do something, and that just added more fuel to his fire, to prove not only to himself but to everybody else that he could play injured and that he was ready to play." More than anything, it was a message to the management of the Chicago Bulls. "That game," Reinsdorf admitted years later, "was when we began to realize just how great Michael could be." It also marked an important moment for Jordan personally. Up to that point, there were so many media guys saying he's good, but he's not in the same class as Magic Johnson or Larry Bird, Jordan said, looking back years later. "I earned Larry Bird's respect. To me, that showed me I was on the right track. Not the points that I scored, because at the end of the day we lost the game. It's a good highlight to watch, but not too much fun, because I lost. That was the biggest compliment I had at that particular time." Enter Collins. A few weeks after the season, Krause fired Stan Albeck, again angering the team's growing fan base. Reinsdorf felt that the coach had stood in the way when they wanted to hold Jordan back from his foot injury. Furthermore, Albeck had rejected the offensive advice of Tex Winter. The choice of replacement came down to two men, broadcaster Doug Collins and, once again, Phil Jackson. Krause agonized a bit, then chose Collins, who had seen a lot of the league as a CBS broadcaster, though he had no coaching experience. "A TV guy? Really?" Reinsdorf had supposedly responded when Krause first posed the idea. But Collins had been a star player at Illinois State and was the top pick of the 1973 draft. He had also played a pivotal role on the ill-fated 1972 U.S. Olympic team. Selected by the Philadelphia 76ers, Collins helped that club climb back from its disastrous 1973 season into championship contention by 1977. A three-time All-Star, Collins ultimately fell victim to the injuries that prematurely ended his career. It was very uncomfortable because Collins was a broadcaster and had traveled with the team before he was hired, recalled Cheryl Ray Stout. Stan Albeck would look over his shoulder, and there was Doug Collins. He served as a consultant briefly, and there was speculation that Collins was taking Stan's job. "When I hired Doug, everybody laughed at me," Krause said. "A lot of people said, 'What the fuck are you doing hiring a TV guy?' At the time, I was 35, Collins would later recall, and there had been 9 coaches in 10 years in Chicago. I was the kind of guy to roll up my sleeves and make something happen." Jordan wasn't so sure about that in the beginning. In fact, he mistrusted Collins as another Krause invention. "When I first met Doug, I didn't think he knew what he was talking about," Jordan recalled. "I wondered when he first got the job. I mean, he was so young, but once I got to know him, I liked him a lot. He was bright, he was in control, and most of all, he was positive." Not only did he bring this strength, but he added assistant coaches Johnny Bach and Gene Littles to the equation. Bach in particular would become a force within the team. Bach recalled of Collins, "I had coached him at the Olympics in 1972 and we had a good friendship and respect for each other. Doug called me and said, 'I'd like you to come here and join the staff.' It was a pleasure to go with Paul Douglas Collins. He was emotional and exciting, fired up. He really started this franchise, the Bulls, to winning again." With a coaching hire completed, Krause turned again to the roster. He sent away Orlando Woolridge, Juwan Oldham, and Sidney Green, and began stockpiling draft picks and cash. For the 1987 draft, he would have a store of first-round picks. But the team headed into the season with just one player on the roster who averaged double figures, and that player was coming off a major foot injury. At the time, the public had no idea just how motivated and angry Michael Jordan was. Krause had brought in a third-year guard from Portland named Steve Coulter, and Jordan set upon him in training camp as if he were Krause himself. In games or at practice, it became increasingly obvious that the sensitive Coulter couldn't play alongside Jordan. Like many point guards, Coulter had trouble playing effectively without the ball in his hands. But Jordan had long had a habit, indulged by each of his coaches, where he would shoo the point guard off during the inbounds, take the pass, bring the ball up, and initiate the offense himself. In time, it would become obvious that John Paxson, who didn't need the ball to be effective, was a better fit alongside Jordan. Krause would trade Coulter before the season was half over and bring in the next in a long line of point guards who couldn't gain traction in Jordan's shadow. Krause hired Jim Stack that year as his right-hand man. Stack had played at Northwestern, then in the pro leagues of Europe. He showed a knack for charting plays and an eye for the game, so in addition to assisting Krause, Stack also did advanced scouting for the team. The Bulls' front office and the team were already separating into two distinct worlds, but Stack's position allowed him to keep a foot in both of them. It was awkward negotiating the internal politics, Stack admitted, but when he wasn't on the road scouting, he was in practice with the team and going over his reports in team meetings. In addition to working for Krause, Stack bonded well with the coaches. Jordan, too. Because of those working relationships, Stack became part of the glue that held the organization together through more than a decade of conflict. Stack had seen a lot of basketball around the world, but the most electrifying play he saw was right there in Bulls practices. "Michael was just a wrecking machine," he recalled, looking back in 2012. "We had more talented players at times playing alongside Michael, but they just couldn't withstand the immense prowess that he brought to the court. Poor Steve Coulter. I thought he was one of the better guards when I got to the team, but Jerry ended up having to move him because he just wilted playing against Michael in practice." Chapter 19. Attack. There was substantial public pressure heading into Doug Collins' first season for the Bulls to upgrade their roster with available scorers such as Eddie Johnson in Sacramento or a big man like Golden State's Joe Barry Carroll. Krause chose to wait, which led to fears among the fan base that the roster had been stripped of talent. There were preseason predictions that winning 30 games again might just be out of the Bulls' reach. Some observers didn't think the Bulls could score enough to win, but those questions were answered on opening night against the Knicks in Madison Square Garden. New York featured a Twin Towers look with Patrick Ewing and Bill Cartwright and used it to take a 5-point lead midway through the fourth quarter. During a timeout, Jordan looked at Collins and said, "Coach, I'm not going to let you lose your first game." He scored the team's final 18 points to drive a 108-103 win. His 50 points set a record for points scored by an opponent in the Garden, which shattered the 44-point mark shared by Rick Barry and former Bull Quentin Daly. "I've never seen anything like Michael Jordan. Ever, ever, never," Collins said after hugging each of his players. Afterward, as reporters listened in, Jordan told his father that the Knicks fans had goaded him into the big scoring night. So you were playing on the crowd, not even on the floor? His father asked, teasing. I always play in the crowd, he replied. The excitement that came to the club from winning the opening game of the season, that was a turning point, Reinsdorf observed, looking back. That was the year things started to build, and Michael was unbelievable. More specifically, it was the year that Jordan took over American basketball. His revolution ran both large and small. He entered the pro game in the age of Daisy Duke shorts, cut tight and short, and promptly created something better to his liking: baggy pants specially tailored 2.5 inches longer. Before too long, players would be taking the court in full-blown knee-length pantaloons, easily his most enduring fashion statement. His play became a style rage as well, with his now routine rock-a-baby dunks. Taking it all in was new assistant coach Johnny Bach. Like Tex Winter, Bach was in his 60s, a former military man and a veteran coach, most recently head coach of the Golden State Warriors. Bach was more than eager to assist both Collins and Jordan, but also like Winter, Bach was somewhat reticent about approaching Jordan at first. Assistant coaches, especially ones with some experience, sometimes you know when you should inject into a scene or when you should stay away from it, Bach recalled in 2012. In those days, I watched him from a distance. His play was so good, you couldn't believe it, the things he could do. I always thought the best thing was just to watch him and be of any assistance I could. Bach's first duties under Collins were doing some advance scouting for the team and breaking down what he saw about opponents in team meetings. That was where he first made a connection with Jordan. In talking about the game, Bach had a knack for using the right phrase, as he called it. I used a lot of military terms because I had come from service with the Navy during the war. Jordan was immediately drawn to his language and his tales of World War II, where Bach had lost his twin brother, an aviator, in combat. It just seemed to catch his attention, Bach recalled. But beyond his language, he had a sparkle in his eye and dressed immaculately, something else that captured Jordan's fancy. The older assistant coach talked often of Admiral William Bull Halsey, who took command of the naval war in the South Pacific and used his words to send messages to an impressionable Jordan during games. I would walk alongside Michael when a timeout was ending and say, "For God's sake, Michael, attack, attack, attack." That's what Halsey said, and that's what I'm telling you, Bach recalled. I'd do that if I thought there was a time he wasn't attacking the basket. I didn't do it often. But he remembered it. That was sort of the beginning of the thing. As an assistant coach, you can't call a play for the guy, but I just thought I'd say, I haven't seen you out there doing the things you can do. The situation, as I saw it, was, why not stimulate him with something like, "Hey Michael, attack, attack, attack." That's the little things I did, and our relationship was good that way. Jordan would begin referring to Bach as his personal coach, whose message became something of a mantra over the course of the season. It was all the encouragement the young star needed to create a new math for the game. He would score better than 40 points on 28 occasions that season. 6 times he ran up better than 50. In late November and early December, he scored more than 40 in 9 straight games, 6 of them coming on a Western road trip. Later, he would insist it was all out of necessity. When I first came here, I had to be the igniter to get the fire going, he recalled. So a lot of my individual skills had to come out. Jump. Word quickly spread among NBA circles that this version of Jordan was something new. In Phoenix, Walter Davis took note, recalled teammate Eddie Pinckney. It was my understanding that Michael kind of idolized Walter a little bit, Pinckney recalled. He was one of his favorite players. Walter at the time was a marquee player. As their first game with the Bulls approached, Pinckney noticed that Davis perked up and began preparing harder than he normally did. That was to me a little bit strange because Walter dominated his position during his time, Pinckney recalled. He never really fretted about playing anyone. I didn't know it, but a huge contingent of players would go back to North Carolina and play during the summer. Walter Davis, it seemed, did not want to give Jordan anything during the NBA season that could be used for trash talk during the summer sessions back in Chapel Hill. I sort of knew what was coming, Pinckney said, but Davis really knew what was coming. Michael put on a show. He actually put on a show. Those two were going at it. I mean, it wasn't about the way in which he scored, it was more about taking over the game. At some point or another, you knew it was coming, these stretches like 10 in a row or 12 in a row. And the way in which he did it was like these crazy assaults to the rim. He jumped from one side to the other and reversed, all that stuff, the wild assaults at the rim. Most of all, Pinckney was struck by how Jordan had affected Davis. "He's a guy who was a really good player," Pinckney said, "and Jordan made him completely alter his approach to the game." Nonetheless, the Bulls lost that game by 2 despite Jordan's 43 points. Afterward, the team doctor lanced Jordan's swollen toe, Jerry Krause recalled. "Pus came out all over that thing. It was ugly. If you saw it, you would want to throw up." The doctor ordered Jordan back to Chicago to rest the toe for 10 days, Krause remembered in a 2012 interview. "Now Michael gets on Doug Collins, and I leave, and 15 minutes later Doug comes out in the hallway and says, 'We've got to talk.' And he tells me what Michael says, that he wants to go to San Antonio the next night. He won't hurt himself, and if it's bad, he won't play. All the stuff you hear from a guy. Well, I was a little soft probably too, so we let him go to San Antonio, and if you look, I think he got 52 that night." Actually, it was another 43 points, another in that 9-game stretch of 40-point games for Jordan, on a bad toe. The Bulls would lose 6 of them, not quite as bad as it sounds, seeing as 8 of the 9 games were on the road. Toward the end of the streak, Jordan scored 41 in Atlanta, but the Hawks' Dominique Wilkins answered with 57. Jordan was getting the best of the league's best each game. As the Celtics had learned in the previous playoffs, he had become unguardable, at least by a single defender. In Jordan's first season, the Lakers had thrown Byron Scott and then Michael Cooper at him and held him down by denying him the ball. "Those days were over," Cooper told one writer. "When people say I do a good job on Michael or that so-and-so did the job, that's wrong. There's no way I stop him. I need the whole team. As soon as he touches the ball, he electrifies the intensity inside you. The alarm goes off because you don't know what he's going to do. He goes right, left, over you, around and under you. He twists, he turns, and you know he's going to get the shot off. You just don't know when and how. That's the most devastating thing psychologically to a defender." The attacking that Bach urged upon him was so creative that Sun-Times sports writer Rick Thielander decided to ask about his leaping ability. "I've never had my vertical leap measured," Jordan replied, "but sometimes I think about how high I get up. I always spread my legs when I jump high, like on my rockababy. And it seems like I've opened a parachute-like that slowly brings me back to the floor. I was really up against New York in our first game. On my last dunk, I think I was close to eye level with a rim. Sometimes you just hit your wrists on the rim, but this time it was my elbows and everything. I almost over-dunked the whole rim." He was as enthusiastic as any fan about his hang time. "I wish I could show you a film of a dunk I had in Milwaukee," Jordan told Thielander. "It's in slow motion. And it looks like I'm taking off, like somebody put wings on me. I get chills when I see it. I think, when does jump become flying? I don't have the answer yet." There was no better place to show off such skills than the slam dunk contest at the All-Star Game weekend. The fans cast a record 1.41 million votes that season to send the player now called His Airness to the All-Star Game. "I think it's great the fans admire my style so much," he said in response. "I'm not going to do anything to disappoint them." In those days, the dunk contest held a special appeal for the game's top athletes, emphasized by the fact that Jordan, less than a year after returning from a broken foot, entered the event at Seattle's Kingdome, where he won with a series of slams that capitalized on his particular brand of flight. Atlanta's Dominique Wilkins was injured. This time, there was no thought of freezing him out in the All-Star main event. Jordan's shadow now fell across the entire league. "Even at an All-Star game, you couldn't take your eyes off of him," observed Mitch Lawrence, the veteran basketball writer for the New York Daily News. "Now you could watch Magic and Bird, don't get me wrong. But that was the thing about Michael Jordan. When you went to see him play, even in just a regular season game, you had to watch him. There could be another superstar or two on the court, it didn't matter. Basically 95% of the time, you're watching Michael Jordan. If he was getting a break, maybe you'd watch the other players, but mostly you were fixated. Now, how many guys can you say that about?" Jordan resumed his pace after the All-Star weekend. In late February, he scored 58 against the Nets, breaking Chet Walker's old Bulls regular season single-game scoring record of 57. A few days later, despite a painful corn on his left foot, he blasted the Pistons for 61 in an overtime win before 30,281 screaming fans at the Pontiac Silverdome. Down the stretch, Jordan and Isaiah Thomas and Adrian Dantley of the Pistons furiously swapped baskets. "Isaiah's play at that time pumped me to another level," Jordan would admit later. "He was making great shots, and then I'd come down and make a great shot. It was great entertainment for the fans and great basketball. Of all his many huge games that season, the Pistons' victory was by far his favorite. "Because we won," he explained. "And because I switched onto Adrian Dantley in the last few minutes, stole the ball three times, and held him without a basket. A victory for defense." Afterward, the shell-shocked Pistons began working to come up with a scheme to prevent any such embarrassment in the future. Jordan seemed to bound from one over-the-top performance to the next. "I don't know how he did it," teammate John Paxson said. "Every night someone else was standing in his face, and he never took a step back." The I in Win. There was something in this unleashed hunger that gnawed at many people across the NBA. Among the few who dared to speak openly about it was Larry Bird, who told a reporter, "I don't like to watch the same guy take every shot. That's not what the game is all about." Jordan thoroughly dominated the ball for Chicago that season, taking almost a third of his team's shots. It would be the first of Jordan's 9 seasons leading the league in field goal attempts. The focus on one player at the expense of the team concept flew in the face of what Bulls assistant Tex Winter believed was important about the game. Despite Winter's misgivings, Doug Collins seemed wholly supportive of Jordan's volume scoring and was perhaps eager for even more, if it meant getting more wins. Originally shy about coaching Jordan, Winter began urging the third-year star toward a more fundamental approach to the game. Jordan immediately bristled. "You know what he told me?" Jordan confided to writer Curry Kirkpatrick. "And when he said this, I knew one of us was over the hill. He told me, 'The highest percentage shot on the drive is to lay it up.' He asked me, 'Why do you go on trying those outrageous jumps and moves and dunks?' I couldn't believe it. I just stared at him and said, 'Hey, I don't plan this stuff, it just happens.'" In his late 60s, Winter had more than 4 decades of first-rate coaching experience as head coach at 5 colleges and the Houston Rockets. His specialty had been the development of the triple post offense, which was by then viewed as antiquated. But where other people in basketball scoffed at Tex Winter as some sort of oddball, Krause had known him for years and deeply admired him and his offense, almost to the point of worship, and was irritated that neither Stan Albeck nor Collins followed Winter's offensive advice. Winter's offense wasn't just X's and O's, as he liked to point out, but a system or philosophy for playing the game, complete with an entire set of related fundamentals. The older assistant was focused on detail in a way that no other pro coach even considered. For example, he was agitated to no end that Jordan couldn't throw a basic chest pass to his liking. Albeck and Collins had resisted Winter's advice mainly because incorporating it would require them to give themselves over to his entire system, where he had each detail of the game spelled out. His system created an attack that offered immaculate floor spacing and a systematic breaking down of the defense. It allowed players to know where they were going to get their shots. Most important, it employed a 2-guard front that allowed for floor balance. Winter's idea was that one player would always be able to get back on defense to prevent easy fast breaks by the opponent. "Tex, in his own way, was a very obstinate, aggressive man," Johnny Bock recalled. "He believed in the triple post probably even before the gospel pages. That was his gospel. He wanted it installed." I don't know if Krause had told him, "Yes, you can put your things in." He not only had to convince Doug, he also had to convince Michael that this is an offense that is not only good for the team, but one that Michael could operate in. That would prove to be a tough sell, made tougher because Jordan saw Winter as one of Krause's guys and thus tainted, and a target for a little fun. "Tex was like a grandpa to all of us," recalled trainer Mark File. "But the players would mock him. Michael used to tease him and stuff, over everything. One time in practice, Michael sneaked up behind him and pulled Tex's shorts all the way down to his knees, and there was Tex's bare butt sticking out." Winter never reported any of this to Krause, but the distance grew between him and Collins, the coach he was supposed to be mentoring. Winter believed he had been hired to teach, so he taught whenever possible, with a sort of frank, direct feedback that most players hadn't heard since middle school. "When we step out on that floor at a practice session, I'm going to coach whoever shows up," Winter once said of his approach. "And I'm going to coach them the way I coach, whether it's Michael Jordan or whoever it is. It doesn't make any difference. They know that. If I see Michael making a mistake, I'll correct him as fast as I will anyone else. On the other hand, he's such a great athlete, you have to handle him a little differently than you do the other players. I don't think you can come down on him hard in a very critical way, whereas some younger guy or some other guy you feel you might be able to motivate by coming down on them pretty tough." Whereas Bock urged Jordan to attack, Winter spoke constantly of the team approach, and his will could be every bit as strong as Jordan's. Conflict simmered within the Chicago coaching staff, exacerbated by Collins's determination to be his own man. He brought an enthusiasm that went beyond the normal, Bock said of Collins in that first season. He was fired up, especially in competition. Some coaches see very little out there. They're very good about what they're teaching, and they don't see much more than that. Indeed, Doug Collins has always been a coach that sees too much. Collins could never seem to leave well enough alone and was always adding new plays to his team's mix. Given the conflict between his parents and the conflict among his coaches, it was no wonder that Jordan seemed to be losing trust in the authority figures around him. Criticism, however, always seemed to get his attention. There was no question that the observations offered by Bird and Winter took Jordan by surprise and left him a bit defensive. "I'm taking these raps as a challenge just to get better and see that my team gets better," he said in one interview. "But it's not as if I'm playing with a bunch of all-leaguers. Anybody who thinks that is a damn fool." In truth, Jordan's growing selfishness when it came to scoring had begun generating resentment among his teammates. Some years later, Jordan himself would come clean on the issue and acknowledge his concentration on self rather than team. At the time, his focus on his own game, his own abilities, seemed impenetrable. He heeded Bock's counsel and persisted in the attack. March brought another streak of 5 40-plus games. In April, he had an opportunity to become the only player since Wilt Chamberlain in 1962-63 to score better than 3,000 points in a season. Chamberlain had done it twice. Jordan scored 53 against Indiana, then 50 against Milwaukee, after which Bucks coach Don Nelson took off his necktie and wrote, "Great season, great person" on it before giving it to Jordan. Nelson was another of the old-style turn-loose-the-assassin coaches who would rather trade subtle insults with Winter and Jackson across the competitive divide. The signed tie was his way of urging Jordan on, just like Bock. The game's offensive monster rewarded his fans with his second 61-point performance of the season, this time against Atlanta in the stadium. He finished the season with 3,041 points and a league-best 37.1 scoring average. During the Atlanta onslaught, he scored an NBA record 23 straight points. At the end of the game, he tossed up a half-court shot that fell just short, enough to leave purists like Winter shaking their heads, even as fans across the league hooted in delight. As Jordan walked off the floor, Winter told him, "There's no I in team." Jordan highlighted the moment in his 2008 Hall of Fame acceptance speech, recalling that he looked at Winter and replied, "Yeah, but there is in win." The moment framed basketball's great debate, indeed the debate of American culture itself, about the individual versus the team or group. Only in retrospect would it become clearer for both Winter and Jordan that the philosophical confrontation they shared would have a profound effect on both of them, their later success, and how they both viewed the game. Meanwhile, Jordan's reward for his season-long offensive display was being left off the first and second NBA all-defensive teams, which infuriated him. That season, he had become the first player in NBA history to record more than 200 steals and 100 block shots. He had 236 steals and 125 blocks. In the history of the league, Jerry West was the only scoring champion to ever make the all-defensive team. Jordan determined that he wanted to be recognized for having the complete game. He had set Bulls records in 6 different single-season categories, all enough to drive Doug Collins's first team to a 40-42 record and another first-round playoff meeting with the Celtics. Bird in Boston, however, swept the series in 3, while Jordan averaged 35.7 points, emphasizing Bird's and Winter's message that team strength could easily outshine a one-man show. Michael Jordan's Chicago Bulls had lost 9 playoff games and won just 1 in his first 3 seasons. "He's a guy whose highlight films you most want to watch," Boston guard Danny Ainge said of Jordan, "but I don't know how much fun he'd be to play with." Even so, it had been the kind of individual year that moved even his most determined critics to speak up. "Everybody always says it's me and Larry," Magic Johnson, whose Lakers defeated the Celtics for the league title that season, told reporters. "Really, it's Mike and everybody else." Jordan and Johnson had identified each other as the game's top players. Once Jordan's high school idol, Johnson now loomed as an unliked rival, and it wasn't just about winning. From the debate within his own team to his relationships with stars on other teams, Jordan faced substantial criticism. It's no secret around the league that, even with his 4 championship rings, Johnson harbors something that seems to be more than professional jealousy toward Jordan, Curry Kirkpatrick wrote in Sports Illustrated. Commercially, at least, Magic should have been Michael 7 years ago when he followed up winning the 1979 NCAA title for Michigan State with a tour de force sixth game in the 1980 NBA Championship Series, which the Lakers won over the Philadelphia 76ers. It clearly still bothered Johnson and other veterans that Jordan's Nike deal and the promotional effort behind it gave him a status above even the league's most accomplished stars. Jordan, meanwhile, didn't hesitate to express his theory that Johnson had been behind Laker owner Jerry Buss's push to trade James Worthy. "I don't hold anything against him," Jordan told Kirkpatrick. "I just think he doesn't like players who come from North Carolina." It didn't help that Johnson and Isaiah Thomas were making much of what was then their high-profile personal friendship. When Johnson sent an invitation to play in his coveted summer All-Star charity game, Jordan tersely declined. It was obvious that the All-Star snubbing 2 years earlier still burned him. The truth was, he faced a staggering array of commitments in the offseason. Jordan had laughed the first time David Falk ran the name Air Jordan past him, but in less than 3 years he had become an unprecedented marketing force, with an estimated $165 million in sales of Nike shoes and merchandise alone. "First, I thought it was a fad," Jordan would say, looking back on the response to his shoe line. "But it's far greater now than it used to be. The numbers are just outrageous." Strangely, Phil Knight had begun to have second thoughts about his company's relationship with Jordan, which set up something of a drama that would unfold over the next year as talks continued about a new contract for Air Jordan. "It was as if MJ had gotten too much power too quickly, and it spooked Knight," Sonny Vaccaro explained. "Such huge sales were difficult to sustain, and a slight dip had given the Nike chairman reason for pause. Phil was ready to get rid of him," Vaccaro remembered. "Phil was ready to sign all of the college teams and forget Michael. I said, you can't do that." First of all, Rob Strasser had left the company and was now advising Jordan to push for his own product line. Knight rejected that idea and persisted in questioning the value of the company's relationship with Jordan until Vaccaro put together some numbers that made it clear that Nike couldn't gain anything near the Air Jordan sales in college markets. Knight had a choice: to cut Jordan loose or to ride this surging, though sometimes frightening, tide. Ultimately, Knight chose to stay the course with Jordan. Eventually, a fat new Nike contract would be signed, a deal that would open the door a few years later for the emergence of the Jordan brand and create unimaginable wealth for an athlete. "He got the big raise, then the Jordan brand," Vaccaro said of Jordan's succeeding deals with the shoe manufacturer. "There's no question he bought in. I mean, it was huge. Michael was in. That was a seminal deal in the history of deals, there's no question. And to Michael's credit and to Nike's credit, they created an empire. He was climbing so fast and the product was so good," Johnny Bock remembered. "He tried on every new pair of shoes they were making. He was very proud of the product. He wanted to make sure he liked what he saw." Jordan's image seemed to become one and the same with Nike as he continued to both embrace and shrink from the metastasizing fame. As if the airtime of the Nike TV ads hadn't been enough, CBS's 60 Minutes had broadcast a 10-minute profile by Diane Sawyer that portrayed a playful, almost sweet Jordan, the kind of image-making you couldn't buy. David Falk was beside himself with glee. Backing up what his agent called 60 Minutes commercial was Jordan's first appearance as a cartoon character in the popular syndicated comic strip Shoe by Pulitzer Prize winner Jeff McNeely, who just happened to be a fellow Tar Heel. There seemed to be no connection that didn't work for Jordan. The first line of toys made in his image was scheduled to appear on shelves that Christmas. Lacey Banks returned to the Bulls beat as a sports writer for the Chicago Sun-Times in 1987 and was introduced to Jordan. His first impression of the star was that Jordan was atop a throne and quite taken with it, Banks recalled with a laugh years later. Michael had come into possession of the world. "It was like he was anointed," Sonny Vaccaro remembered. "I mean, seriously, everything. I mean, even where he did something contrary to what was supposed to happen, it would come out all right." Indeed, fans and opponents alike were beginning to grasp that the arc of Jordan's rise was broader and much, much higher than anyone had imagined. "In the age of TV sports," David Falk observed that summer of 1987, "if you were to create a media athlete and star for the 90s, spectacular talent, mid-sized, well-spoken, attractive, accessible, old-time values, wholesome, clean, natural, not too goody-two-shoes, with a little bit of deviltry in him, you'd invent Michael. He's the first modern crossover in team sports. We think he transcends race, transcends basketball. Things were changing, and Michael was in the middle of it, Sonny Vaccaro explained. He was doing commercials for everybody, you know, and he became this entity. McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Chevrolet, Wilson Sporting Goods, and a half dozen other companies used him to promote their products. The sums they paid him dwarfed his five-year, $4 million Bulls contract, which meant that his schedule that summer was packed with everything from hosting TV shows to throwing out pitches at Major League Baseball games. It took getting used to, but now I enjoy all the off-court stuff, Jordan said during a quick promotional trip to Pittsburgh that summer. It's like being back in school. I'm learning all the time. In college, I never realized the opportunities available to a pro athlete. I've been given the chance to meet all kinds of people, to travel and expand my financial capabilities, to get ideas and learn about life, to create a world apart from basketball. A big part of that world apart appeared more and more to include Juanita Vanoy. He had proposed on New Year's Eve, just as they were looking out across 1987 and wondering at all the bounty it seemed poised to bring. Indeed, he had purchased a new 5-bedroom, 5,000-square-foot home north of Chicago. As she helped him decorate it, they began to articulate the kind of life they might share together. The news of the engagement did not sit well with his parents, who remained caught in their own struggle for influence over his life. The discreet activities that made James Jordan smile were the stuff of nightmares for Michael's mother and fiancé. We live in a very tempting world, Sonny Vaccaro explained. At that level, at Michael's level, it's unbelievable. He was good-looking, a young guy on top of the world. The stories are out there, but these things are just indigenous to fame and fortune. It's hard to be an idol. Vaccaro traveled and worked with Jordan often enough to be surprised, even amazed, by his discretion. Even though he was young, Jordan was obviously wise enough not to put his friends and associates in awkward positions. He had his moments, but he was no rampant womanizer like Magic Johnson, who later claimed to have slept with as many as 500 women a year at the height of his stardom. To Vaccaro, the fact that Jordan was able to negotiate the tests of stardom further demonstrated the surprising scope of his talents and gifts. When you talk about Michael, he obviously had that thing, that crossover appeal, whatever the hell it was, the older man said. I use the word charisma, but it's like nobody can define what that really means. All the things we're talking about in his life, including the personal battle within his family, he overcame all that. There's something truly rare about that. There aren't too many human beings who can do that in any walk of life. Part 7. The Cynic. Chapter 20. That's Entertainment. His older sister had seen it in him as a child. His father and even Red Auerbach had identified it as his career was taking off. Jordan loved to entertain the crowd. His relationship with the audience was growing in ways that those around him struggled to fathom, including the university scholars who had begun to study him as a force in popular culture. Yet even as he ceded his existence over to the public domain, there remained much that Jordan kept hidden. He did this willfully, out of his growing instinct for self-preservation and his insistence that parts of his life were no one else's business. Johnny Bock witnessed this with a new sense of awe. An intense student of both the game and human nature, Bock was a grand philosopher, blessed with both charm and sincerity. Who knows where the narrative of Michael Jordan and the NBA might have gone had it not been for Bock and their conversations. If his eyes would light up and he was listening, I was fortunate that he listened, Bock said of their relationship and his opportunity to work with the game's greatest player. Jordan fought to keep his self-indulgence private as well as the burdens he chose to bear beyond the game. I thought, in the early days, he was doing so much it was unbelievable, Bock recalled. He always visited with some person or child who had a last wish. He never turned anyone down. Every night he faced that, and I could never understand how he was strong enough to do it. Kids that were burned, brutalized, and dying by disease or something else. I can still remember he saw a kid who was brought in whose father had burned his face off him. They brought him in, and Michael talked to him in that old dressing room we had in Chicago Stadium before the game. He just talked to him. You couldn't imagine a kid that was hideously burned. And Michael just talked to him. He put him on the bench, and during the game he would come over and ask, "How'd you like that jump shot?" One of the officials came over and said, "Michael, you can't have that kid on the bench. It's against league rules." And Michael looked at him and said, "He's on the bench." He left our team timeouts to talk to the kid. I can remember John Paxson and I having tears in our eyes looking at that scene, because the kid was so hideously burned. And here's Michael talking to him. So he had that greatness in him. It brought out scenes like that. That was repeated many times. He was a Wonder Man. Jordan seemed to draw from the same vast emotional store that fueled his competitiveness, Bach recalled. I felt that they abused it. He was asked for so many things by so many people that he had to have been wearied by all of these requests, but he always seemed to accommodate those that needed him the most. He went up in stature, not just as a player, but as an individual who could take that scene and make that child happy. I couldn't do it, I'll tell you that. I would have, and did, almost break down. He took pressures exceedingly well, whether it was the demand of the press, or the demand of the organization, or the demands of the game itself, basketball. He came out and did it more often than anyone else could do it. He had few poor nights. A poor night for him would be an all-star night for someone else. I admire him to this day. How he accommodated so many people, I'll never know. Never. Jerry Krause, too, admired Jordan's innate ability with the less fortunate. The GM recalled that the only time the young star chafed at such duty was if someone tried to turn the moment into a public relations event. The things he did were to be kept quiet, strictly behind the scenes, Jordan ordered. He did those kinds of things all the time, Tim Hallam remembered. There was only one stipulation. He wasn't doing it for the publicity. He insisted on keeping things quiet. Absolutely no press. Of course, the last thing Jordan seemed to need was a public relations effort. His performances on the floor assured that. And he privately complained that he already suffered enough from the perfection of his image. The audience had long displayed a weakness for sports stars and a strong desire to believe the very best about them, having elevated an array of figures to mythic status over what had come to be described as the sports century. Little did anyone realize that this adulation of Jordan was just the beginning. The boom in shoe sales mirrored the exploding business of the team itself. In Jordan's three seasons, the value of the franchise had more than tripled and continued to grow with each tip-off. Jerry Reinsdorf was so pleased with these developments that he extended Doug Collins' year-old contract and made plans to give Jordan a new extended deal. Chicago's home attendance had grown by nearly 200,000 to 650,718, a jump of nearly a third over the previous year, when Jordan missed 34 home games. On the road, the Bulls also punched up the entire league's attendance by drawing an extra 276,996 fans, which generated another $3.71 million in revenue. The other owners recognized that the new Golden Goose was not Reinsdorf's alone. The increased popularity and cash flow boosted the confidence around the team. "We've reached a respect factor in this city," Collins told reporters. "We're no longer considered the Bad News Bulls." Wooly Bully. All of these gains had been made, and the franchise had yet to hire Phil Jackson or to draft Scottie Pippen. Michael Jordan didn't know either of them, the two major relationships of his professional life, in the spring of 1987. Pippen would arrive via the 1987 draft, and Jackson would join the Bulls' employ that offseason as an assistant coach, charged with advanced scouting and other lower-ranked duties. Mostly, Krause wanted Jackson there so that he could pair him with Tex Winter for tutelage. Somehow, Krause talked Collins into hiring Jackson, who remained basketball's odd duck, an intellectual sort who wore feathers in his hat and had the reputation for LSD usage revealed in his book. But this time, pro basketball's resident hippie shaved and donned a tie for the interview, per Krause's instructions. Jordan had never heard of Jackson when he came to the team, and eyed him suspiciously as another Krause invention, but the initial impressions were strong enough to overcome the vibe. It wasn't articulated that Jackson would be waiting in the wings as Collins's replacement, but such things were understood in the insular world of the NBA, and they generally made for tense palace intrigue. The NBA hadn't really made use of assistant coaches until the late 60s and early 70s because most franchises couldn't afford them or wouldn't pay for them. And why should Collins trust Krause, who had already fired two coaches in 2 years on the job? Still, the arrangement worked somewhat in Chicago because Jackson, for all his ego, was low-key and reserved. The Bulls were a collection of strong personalities, with Jordan, Jackson, Collins, Bach, and Winter all somehow drawn together by this strange little man named Krause, and all kept on their toes by Jordan's growing frustration and cynicism. He had little faith in Krause's ability to find any sort of solutions for the team, and he remained quite angry over what he viewed as the GM's bungling of his return from foot injury. Yet Jordan had been raised to be respectful, both by his parents and by Dean Smith. He knew chain of command. He might take an occasional playful shot in a media interview, but when reporters asked him directly about the team's personnel, Jordan often deferred, saying personnel issues weren't his job. Behind the scenes, though, he had plenty of doubt, and the 1987 draft would bring those doubts into focus, as Krause had worked to give the team two first-round picks. Pippen, taken with the fifth overall pick in a deal with the Seattle Supersonics, was not an item of excessive internal debate. The 10th pick, however, grew into an issue, with both Dean Smith and Jordan exerting a certain pressure on Krause to select North Carolina's Joe Wolf or perhaps even Kenny Smith. Increasingly, GMs had grown leery of some Carolina players. Smith's system had made it hard to judge their talents. Plus, the coach was persuasive, and he always wanted his players to be drafted as high as possible. An NBA GM could wind up in trouble if he let Smith cloud his thinking. Krause was on edge that draft night about the 10th pick, but Reinsdorf told him to go with his gut. So Krause selected Clemson's Horace Grant over Joe Wolf, which infuriated Dean Smith. The selection of a Clemson player over a Carolina player was galling to the coach because it could be used against him in recruiting. "Dean Smith called me," Krause recalled, "and ripped my rear end, literally. 'How could you do that, you dumbbell? Literally.' And Michael said, 'What the hell, you took that dummy?' And for years, that's what he called Horace, dummy. To his face, dummy, right to his face." Krause had not consulted with Jordan about the pick, although he knew well what would have pleased him. "I talked to players, but I didn't talk to Michael because he wasn't old enough to understand at that point," Krause recalled. What was more unusual, the players he consulted with over personnel issues were on other teams. He often talked to Robert Parrish of the Celtics and Brad Davis of the Mavericks. "Those relationships had built up over years," Krause later confided, "and they could tell me things because they had played against guys." "Michael and I don't look at things alike," Krause explained in 1995. "Michael would have wanted me to have Buzz Peterson here the first couple of years, his college roommate. We used to kid about that all the time. Walter Davis was another one. He begged me to get Walter Davis. I wouldn't do it." The situation fed into the growing animosity between the two men. A year earlier, Krause had picked Brad Sellers over Jordan's friend from Duke, Johnny Dawkins. Now he bypassed a solid player from North Carolina. Years later, Krause would offer that Joe Wolf would probably have turned out just fine with the Bulls, that the North Carolina forward failed to develop mostly because he went to the lowly Los Angeles Clippers. Yet at the time, it was Jordan's experience that no one knew players better than Dean Smith, and no stamp of approval was stronger than the Tar Heel logo. It was why he wore Carolina practice shorts under his Bulls uniform each game night, and under his street clothes each day. He believed deeply in all things Carolina. He had won a championship with Carolina, while the Bulls had been mostly a tinhorn operation, managed by the chaotic, insecure Krause, who had presented him with three coaches in less than three seasons. Beyond all of that, Jordan just hated dealing with Krause, recalled the Sun-Times' Lacey Banks. "Krause made it a lot more difficult than was necessary, and that's why Michael hated him." By now, it was public knowledge that Jordan had nicknamed the team vice president Crumbs, because everything he ate, and he ate a lot, supposedly looked good on him. "Crumbs and I, we keep our distance," he told Sports Illustrated that offseason. In time, Jordan would become less guarded about his disdain for the humorless GM. Over the coming seasons, when Krause came into the locker room, Jordan would sometimes lead his teammates in mooing or humming the theme music to Green Acres, antics that Krause mostly ignored or failed to recognize altogether. When training camp started that fall, Jordan did what he always did. He turned the full force of his competitiveness on Krause's rookies and player acquisitions to see if they were strong enough mentally to compete. That was increasingly becoming a ritualistic test with Jordan. He had to see for himself to confirm independently the work the GM was doing. Jordan's insistence and anger over personnel issues would settle into a theme that years later would haunt his own life as a basketball executive. The truth was that a lot of NBA players simply weren't ready to compete alongside Michael Jordan, no matter what school they came from or who drafted them. Anyone who had made the roster was well aware of the mental gauntlet he required each teammate to run. It seemed obvious that he had little faith in those around him. Michael initially thought he could just take over the game and always win it by himself, Bulls scout Jim Stack observed. And he did that a lot, obviously, in the key time of the game to help us win. "Until he really embraced his teammates and the idea that he could help us, I thought we were stuck for a while." Much of his help, the